He tossed his bourbon off at a gulp, and then began to laugh. He rocked back and forth, stockinged feet hitting the linoleum, laughing, and Todd thought he had never looked so much like a vulture in a bathrobe, a noisome beast of carrion. "I hate you," he whispered. And then Dusander began to choke on his own laughter. His face turned a dull brick color. It sounded as if he were coughing, laughing, and strangling all at the same time. Todd, scared, got up quickly and clapped him on the back until the coughing fit had passed. "Danke schön," he said. "Drink your drink. It will do you good." Todd drank it. It tasted like very bad cold medicine and lit a fire in his gut. "I can't believe you drink this shit all day," he said, putting the glass back on the table and shuddering. "You ought to quit it. Quit drinking and smoking." "Your concern for my health is touching," Dusander said. He produced a crumpled pack of cigarettes from the same bathrobe pocket into which the jackknife had disappeared. "And I am equally solicitous of your own welfare, boy. Almost every day I read in the paper where a cyclist has been killed at a busy intersection. You should give it up. You should walk or ride the bus like me." "Why don't you go fuck yourself?" Todd burst out. "My boy," Dusander said, pouring more bourbon and beginning to laugh again. "We are fucking each other. Didn't you know that?" One day, about a week later, Todd was sitting on a disused mail platform down in the old train yard. He chucked cinders out across the rusty, weed-infested tracks one at a time. Why shouldn't I kill him anyway? Because he was a logical boy, the logical answer came first. No reason at all. Sooner or later, Dusander was going to die, and given Dusander's habits, it would probably be sooner. Whether he killed the old man, or whether Dusander died of a heart attack in his bathtub, it was all going to come out. At least he could have the pleasure of wringing the old vulture's neck. Sooner or later, that phrase defied logic. Maybe it'll be later, Todd thought. Cigarettes or not, booze or not, he's a tough old bastard. He's lasted this long, so maybe it'll be later. From beneath him came a fuzzy snort. Todd jumped to his feet, dropping a handful of cinders he had been holding. That snorting sound came again. He paused on the verge of running, but the snort didn't recur. 900 yards away, an eight-lane freeway swept across the horizon above this weed and junk-strewn cul-de-sac with its deserted buildings, rusty cyclone fences, and splintery warped platforms. The cars up on the freeway glistened in the sun like exotic hard-shelled beetles. Eight lanes of traffic up there. Nothing down here but Todd, a few birds, and whatever had snorted. Cautiously he bent down, with his hands on his knees, and peered under the mail platform. There was a wino lying up in there, among the yellow weeds and empty cans and dusty old bottles. It was impossible to tell his age. Todd put him at somewhere between 30 and 400. He was wearing a strappy T-shirt that was caked with dried vomit, green pants that were far too big for him, and grey leather work shoes cracked in 100 places. The cracks gaped like agonized mouths. Todd thought he smelled like Dusander's cellar. The wino's red-laced eyes opened slowly and stared at Todd with a bleary lack of wonder. As they did, Todd thought of the Swiss Army knife in his pocket, the Angler model. He had purchased it at a sporting goods store in Redondo Beach almost a year ago. He could hear the clerk that had waited on him in his mind. "You couldn't pick a better knife than that one, son. Knife like that could save your life someday. We sell 1,500 Swiss knives every damn year." 1,500 a year. He put his hand in his pocket and gripped the knife. In his mind's eye, he saw Dusander's jackknife working slowly around the neck of the bourbon bottle, slitting the seal. A moment later, he became aware that he had an erection. Cold terror stole into him. The wino swiped a hand over his cracked lips and then licked them with a tongue which nicotine had turned a permanent, dismal yellow. "Got a dime, kid?" Todd looked at him expressionlessly. "Gotta get to L.A. I need another dime for the bus. I got an appointment, me. Got a job opportunity. A nice kid like you must have a dime. Maybe you got a quarter." "Yes, sir, you could clean out a damn bluegill with a knife like that. Hell, you could clean out a damn Marlin with it if you had to. We sell 1,500 of those a year. Every sporting goods store and Army-Navy surplus in America sells them. And if you decided to use this one to clean out some dirty, shitty old wino, nobody could trace it back to you. Absolutely nobody. The wino's voice dropped. It became a confidential, tenebrous whisper. For a buck, I'd do you a blowjob. You never had it better. You'd gum your brains out, kid. Todd pulled his hand out of his pocket. He wasn't sure what was in it until he opened it. 2 quarters, 2 nickels, a dime, some pennies. He threw them at the wino and fled. 12. June 1975. Todd Bowden, now 14, came biking up Deucender's Walk and parked his bike on the kickstand. The L.A. Times was on the bottom step. He picked it up. He looked at the bell, below which the neat legends Arthur Denker and No Solicitors, No Peddlers, No Salesmen still kept their places. He didn't bother with the bell now, of course. He had his key. Somewhere close by was the popping, burping sound of a lawn boy. He looked at Deucender's grass and saw it could use a cutting. He would have to tell the old man to find a boy with a mower. Deucender forgot little things like that more often now. Maybe it was senility. Maybe it was just the pickling influence of ancient age on his brains. That was an adult thought for a boy of 14 to have, but such thoughts no longer struck Todd as singular. He had many adult thoughts these days. Most of them were not so great. He let himself in. He had his usual instant of cold terror as he entered the kitchen and saw Deucender slumped slightly sideways in his rocker, the cup on the table, a half-empty bottle of bourbon beside it. A cigarette had burned its entire length down to a lacy gray ash in a mayonnaise cover where several other butts had been mashed out. Deucender's mouth hung open. His face was yellow. His big hands dangled limply over the rocker's arms. He didn't seem to be breathing. "Deucender," he said, a little too harshly. "Rise and shine, Deucender." He felt a wave of relief as the old man twitched, blinked, and finally sat up. "Is it you? And so early." "They let us out early on the last day of school," Todd said. He pointed to the remains of the cigarette in the mayonnaise cover. "Someday you'll burn down the house doing that." "Maybe," Deucender said indifferently. He fumbled out his cigarettes, shot one from the pack that almost rolled off the edge of the table before Deucender was able to catch it, and at last got it going. A protracted fit of coughing followed, and Todd winced in disgust. When the old man really got going, Todd half expected him to start spitting out grayish-black chunks of lung tissue onto the table, and he'd probably grin as he did it. At last the coughing eased enough for Deucender to say, "What have you got there?" "Report card." Deucender took it, opened it, and held it away from him at arm's length so he could read it. "English, A. American History, A. Earth Science, B+. Your community and you, A. Primary French, B-. Beginning algebra, B." He put it down. "Very good. What is the slang? We have saved your bacon, boy. Will you have to change any of these averages in the last column?" "French and algebra. But no more than 8 or 9 points in all. I don't think any of this is ever going to come out. And I guess I owe that to you. I'm not proud of it, but it's the truth. So thanks." "What a touching speech," Deucender said, and began to cough again. "I guess I won't be seeing you around too much from now on," Todd said, and Deucender abruptly stopped coughing. "No?" he said, politely enough. "No," Todd said. "We're going to Hawaii for a month, starting on June 25th. In September, I'll be going to school across town. It's this busing thing." "Oh, yes, the Schwarzen," Deucender said, idly watching a fly as it trundled across the red and white check of the oilcloth. "For 20 years this country has worried and whined about the Schwarzen, but we know the solution, don't we, boy?" He smiled toothlessly at Todd, and Todd looked down, feeling the old sickening lift and drop in his stomach. Terror, hate, and a desire to do something so awful it could only be fully contemplated in his dreams. "Look, I plan to go to college, in case you didn't know," Todd said. "I know that's a long time off, but I think about it. I even know what I want to major in, history."
"Admirable. He who will not learn from the past is—" "Oh, shut up," Todd said.
Dusander did so amiably enough. He knew the boy wasn't done. Not yet. He sat with his hands folded, watching him. "I could get my letter back from my friend," Todd suddenly blurted. "You know that? I could let you read it, and then you could watch me burn it. If I would remove a certain document from my safety deposit box." "Well, yeah." Dusander uttered a long, windy, rueful sigh. "My boy," he said, "still you do not understand the situation. You never have, right from the beginning. Partly because you are only a boy, but not entirely. Even in the beginning you were a very old boy. No, the real villain was and is your absurd American self-confidence that never allowed you to consider the possible consequences of what you were doing, which does not allow it even now." Todd began to speak, and Dusander raised his hand adamantly, suddenly the world's oldest traffic cop. "No, don't contradict me. It's true. Go on if you like. Leave the house. Get out of here. Never come back. Can I stop you? No, of course I can't. Enjoy yourself in Hawaii while I sit in this hot, grease-smelling kitchen and wait to see if the Schwarzen and Watts will decide to start killing policemen and burning their shitty tenements again this year. I can't stop you any more than I can stop getting older a day at a time." He looked at Todd fixedly, so fixedly that Todd looked away. "Down deep inside, I don't like you. Nothing could make me like you. You forced yourself on me. You are an unbidden guest in my house. You have made me open crypts perhaps better left shut, because I have discovered that some of the corpses were buried alive, and that a few of those still have some wind left in them. You yourself has become enmeshed, but do I pity you because of that, Gott im Himmel? You have made your bed. Should I pity you if you sleep badly in it? No, I don't pity you, and I don't like you, but I have come to respect you a little bit. So don't try my patience by asking me to explain this twice. We could obtain our documents and destroy them here in my kitchen, and still it would not be over. We would, in fact, be no better off than we are at this minute."
"I don't understand you."
"No, because you have never studied the consequences of what you have set in motion. But attend me, boy. If we burned our letters here in this jar cover, how would I know you hadn't made a copy? Or two, or three? Down at the library they have a Xerox machine. For a nickel anyone can make a photocopy. For a dollar you could post a copy of my death warrant on every street corner for 20 blocks. 2 miles of death warrants, boy. Think of it. Can you tell me how I would know you hadn't done such a thing?"
I...
Todd realized he was floundering and forced himself to shut his mouth. All of a sudden, his skin felt too warm, and for no reason at all he found himself remembering something that had happened when he was 7 or 8. He and a friend of his had been crawling through a culvert, which ran beneath the old freight bypass road just out of town. The friend, skinnier than Todd, had had no problem, but Todd had gotten stuck. He had become suddenly aware of the feet of rock and earth over his head, all that dark weight, and when an L.A.-bound semi passed above, shaking the earth and making the corrugated pipe vibrate with a low, tuneless and somehow sinister note, he had begun to cry and struggle witlessly, throwing himself forward, pistoning with his legs, yelling for help. At last he had gotten moving again, and when he finally struggled out of the pipe, he had fainted. Dusander had just outlined a piece of duplicity so fundamental that it had never even crossed his mind. He could feel his skin getting hotter, and he thought, "I won't cry. And how would you know I hadn't made 2 copies for my safety deposit box? That I had burned one and left the other there?" "Trapped. I'm trapped, just like in the pipe that time. And who are you going to yell for now?" His heart speeded up at his chest. He felt sweat break on the backs of his hands and the nape of his neck. He remembered how it had been in that pipe. The smell of old water, the feel of the cool ribbed metal, the way everything shook when the truck passed overhead. He remembered how hot and desperate the tears had been. "Even if there were some impartial third party we could go to, always there would be doubts.
The problem is insoluble, boy. Believe it.
Trapped. Trapped in the pipe. No way out of this one. He felt the world go grey. Won't cry. Won't faint. He forced himself to come back. Dusander took a deep drink from his cup and looked at Todd over the rim. Now I tell you two more things. First, that if your part in this matter came out, your punishment would be quite small. It is even possible, no more than that likely, that it would never come out in the papers at all. I frightened you with reform school once when I was badly afraid you might crack and tell everything, but do I believe that? No. I used it the way a father will use the boogerman to frighten a child into coming home before dark. I don't believe that they would send you there. Not in this country where they spank killers on the wrist and send them out onto the streets to kill again after 2 years of watching color TV in a penitentiary. But it might well ruin your life all the same. There are records, and people talk. Always they talk. Such a juicy scandal is not allowed to wither. It is bottled like wine. And, of course, as the years pass, your culpability will grow with you. Your silence will grow more damning. If the truth came out today, people would say, but he is just a child, not knowing as I do what an old child you are. But what would they say, boy, if the truth about me, coupled with the fact that you knew about me as early as 1974, but kept silent, came out while you were in high school? That would be bad. For it to come out while you're in college would be disaster. As a young man just starting out in business, Armageddon. You understand this first thing?
Todd was silent, but Dusander seemed satisfied. He nodded.
Still nodding, he said, Second, I don't believe you have a letter.
Todd strove to keep a poker face, but he was terribly afraid his eyes had widened in shock. Dusander was studying him avidly, and Todd was suddenly, nakedly aware that this old man had interrogated hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people. He was an expert. Todd felt that his skull had turned to window glass, and all things were flashing inside in large letters.
I asked myself, whom would you trust so much? Who are your friends? Whom do you run with? Whom does this boy, this self-sufficient, coldly controlled little boy, go to with his loyalty? The answer is nobody.
Dusander's eyes gleamed yellowly.
Many times I have studied you and calculated the odds. I know you. And I know much of your character. No, not all, because one human being can never know everything that is in another human being's heart. But I know so little about what you do and whom you see outside of this house. So I think, Dusander, there is a chance that you are wrong. After all these years, do you want to be captured and maybe killed because you misjudged a boy? Maybe when I was younger I would have taken the chance. The odds are good odds, and the chance is a small chance. It is very strange to me, you know. The older one becomes, the less one has to lose in matters of life and death. And yet one becomes more and more conservative.
He looked hard into Todd's face.
I have one more thing to say, and then you can go when you want. What I have to say is that, while I doubt the existence of your letter, never doubt the existence of mine. The document I have described to you exists. If I die today, tomorrow everything will come out. Everything.
Then there's nothing for me, Todd said. He uttered a dazed little laugh. Don't you see that?
What there is, years will go by. And as they pass, your hold on me will become worth less and less, because no matter how important my life and liberty remain to me, the Americans, and yes, even the Israelis, will have less and less interest in taking them away.
Yeah? Then why don't they let that guy Hess go?
If the Americans had sole custody of him, the Americans who let killers out with a spank on the wrist, they would have let him go, Dusander said. Are the Americans going to allow the Israelis to extradite an 80-year-old man so they can hang him as they hanged Eichmann? I think not. Not in a country where they put photographs of firemen rescuing kittens from trees on the front pages of city newspapers. No, your hold over me will weaken, even as mine over you grows stronger. No situation is static, and there will come a time, if I live long enough, when I will decide what you know no longer matters. Then I will destroy the document.
But so many things could happen to you in between. Accident, sickness, disease.
Dusander shrugged. There will be water if God wills it, and we will find it if God wills it, and we will drink it if God wills it. What happens is not up to us.
Todd looked at the old man for a long time, for a very long time. There were flaws in Dusander's arguments. There had to be. A way out. An escape hatch, either for both of them or for Todd alone. A way to cry it off. Times, guys, I hurt my foot, ollie ollie in free. A black knowledge of the years ahead trembled somewhere behind his eyes. He could feel it there, waiting to be born as conscious thought. Everywhere he went, everything he did. He thought of a cartoon character with an anvil suspended over its head. By the time he graduated from high school, Dusander would be 81, and that would not be the end. By the time he collected his B.A., Dusander would be 85, and he would still feel that he wasn't old enough. He would finish his master's thesis in graduate school the year Dusander turned 87, and Dusander still might not feel safe.
No, Todd said thickly. What you're saying, I can't face that.
My boy, Dusander said gently. And Todd heard for the first time, and with dawning horror, the slight accent the old man had put on the first word.
My boy, you must.
Todd stared at him, his tongue swelling and thickening in his mouth, until it seemed it must fill his throat and choke him. Then he wheeled and blundered out of the house. Dusander watched all of this with no expression at all. And when the door had slammed shut and the boy's running footsteps stopped, meaning that he had mounted his bike, he lit a cigarette. There was, of course, no safe deposit box, no document. But the boy believed those things existed. He had believed utterly. He was safe. It was ended. But it was not ended. That night they both dreamed of murder, and both of them awoke in mingled terror and exhilaration. Todd awoke with the now familiar stickiness of his lower belly. Dusander, too old for such things, put on the SS uniform and then lay down again, waiting for his racing heart to slow. The uniform was cheaply made and already beginning to fray. In Dusander's dream, he had finally reached the camp at the top of the hill. The wide gate slid open for him and then rumbled shut on its steel track once he was inside. Both the gate and the fence surrounding the camp were electrified. His scrawny, naked pursuers threw themselves against the fence in wave after wave. Dusander had laughed at them, and he had strutted back and forth, his chest thrown out, his cap cocked at exactly the right angle. The high, whiny smell of burning flesh filled the black air, and he had awakened in Southern California, thinking of jack-o'-lanterns and the night when vampires seek the blue flame. 2 days before the Bowdens were scheduled to fly to Hawaii, Todd went back to the abandoned train yard where folks had once boarded trains for San Francisco, Seattle, and Las Vegas, where other older folks had once boarded the trolley for Los Angeles. It was nearly dusk when he got there. On the curve of the freeway 900 yards away, most of the cars were now showing their parking lights. Although it was warm, Todd was wearing a light jacket. Tucked into his belt under it was a butcher knife wrapped in an old hand towel. He had purchased the knife in a discount department store, one of the big ones surrounded by acres of parking lot. He looked under the platform where the wino had been the month before. His mind turned and turned, but it turned on nothing. Everything inside him at that moment was shades of black on black. What he found was the same wino, or possibly another. They all looked pretty much the same. Hey, Todd said. Hey, you want some money? The wino turned over, blinking. He saw Todd's wide, sunny grin, and began to grin back. A moment later the butcher knife descended, all wicker snicker and chrome white, slicker slicing through the stubbly right cheek. Blood sprayed. Todd could see the blade in the wino's opening mouth, and then its tip caught for a moment in the left corner of the wino's lips, pulling his mouth into an insanely cockeyed grin. Then it was the knife that was making the grin. He was carving the wino like a Halloween pumpkin. He stabbed the wino 37 times. He kept count. 37, counting the first strike, which went through the wino's cheek and then turned his tentative smile into a great, grisly grin. The wino stopped trying to scream after the fourth stroke. He stopped trying to scramble away from Todd after the sixth. Todd then crawled all the way under the platform and finished the job. On his way home, he threw the knife into the river. His pants were bloodstained. He tossed them into the washing machine and set it to wash cold. There were still faint stains on the pants when they came out, but that didn't concern him. They would fade in time. He found the next day that he could barely lift his right arm to the level of his shoulder. He told his father he must have strained it throwing pepper with some of the guys in the park. "It'll get better in Hawaii," Dick Bowden said, ruffling Todd's hair. And it did. By the time they came home, it was as good as new. 13. It was July again. Doosander, carefully dressed in one of his three suits, not his best, was standing at the bus stop and waiting for the last local of the day to take him home. It was 10:45 p.m. He had been to a film, a light and frothy comedy that he had enjoyed a great deal. He had been in a fine mood ever since the morning mail. There had been a postcard from the boy, a glossy color photo of Waikiki Beach with bone-white high-rise hotels standing in the background. There was a brief message on the reverse. "Dear Mr. Denker, boy, this sure is some place. I've been swimming every day. My dad caught a big fish, and my mom is catching up on her reading joke. Tomorrow we're going to a volcano. I'll try not to fall in. Hope you're okay. Stay healthy, Todd." He was still smiling faintly at the significance of that last, when a hand touched his elbow. "Mister?" "Yes?" He turned, on his guard. Even in Santo Donato, muggers were not unknown, and then winced at the aroma. It seemed to be a combination of beer, halitosis, dried sweat, and possibly mustard oil. It was a bum in baggy pants. Wore a flannel shirt and very old loafers that were currently being held together with dirty bands of adhesive tape. The face looming above this motley costume looked like the death of God. "You got an extra dime, mister? Gotta get to L.A., me. Got a job opportunity. I need just a dime more for the express bus. Wouldn't ask if it wasn't a big chance for me." Doosander had begun to frown, but now his smile reasserted itself. "Is it really a bus ride you wish?" The wino smiled sickly, not understanding. "Suppose you ride the bus home with me," Doosander proposed. "I can offer you a drink, a meal, a bath, and a bed. All I ask in return is a little conversation. I am an old man. I live alone. Company is sometimes very welcome." The drunk smile abruptly grew more healthy as the situation clarified itself. Here was a well-to-do old faggot with a taste for slumming.
"All by yourself. Bitch, innit?"
Doosander answered the broad, insinuating grin with a polite smile. "I only ask that you sit away from me on the bus. You smell rather strongly."
"Maybe you don't want me stinking up your place, then,"
the drunk said with sudden tipsy dignity. "Come, the bus will be here in a minute. Get off one stop after I do, and then walk back two blocks. I'll wait for you on the corner. In the morning I will see what I can spare. Perhaps $2.
Maybe even $5,
the drunk said brightly. His dignity, tipsy or otherwise, had been forgotten. "Perhaps, perhaps," Doosander said impatiently. He could now hear the low diesel drone of the approaching bus. He pressed a quarter the correct bus fare into the bum's grimy hand and strolled a few paces away without looking back. The bum stood undecided as the headlights of the local swept over the rise.
He was still standing and frowning down at the quarter when the old faggot got on the bus without looking back. The bum began to walk away, and then, at the last second, he reversed direction and boarded the bus just before the doors folded closed. He put the quarter into the fare box with the expression of a man putting $100 down on a long shot. He passed Dusander without doing more than glancing at him and sat at the back of the bus. He dozed off a little, and when he woke up, the rich old faggot was gone. He got off at the next stop, not knowing if it was the right one or not, and not really caring. He walked back two blocks and saw a dim shape under the streetlight. It was the old faggot, all right. The faggot was watching him approach, and he was standing as if at attention. For just a moment, the bum felt a chill of apprehension, an urge to just turn away and forget the whole thing. Then the old man was gripping him by the arm, and his grip was surprisingly firm. "Good," the old man said. "I'm very glad you came. My house is down here. It's not far."
"Maybe even 10," the bum said, allowing himself to be led.
"Maybe even 10," the old faggot agreed, and then laughed. "Who knows?" 14. The bicentennial year arrived. Todd came by to see Dusander half a dozen times between his return from Hawaii in the summer of 1975 and the trip he and his parents took to Rome, just as all the drum-thumping, flag-waving, and tall ships-watching was approaching its climax. These visits to Dusander were low-key and in no way unpleasant. The two of them found they could pass the time civilly enough. They spoke more in silences than they did in words, and their actual conversations would have put an FBI agent to sleep. Todd told the old man that he had been seeing a girl named Angela Farrow off and on. He wasn't nuts about her, but she was the daughter of one of his mother's friends. The old man told Todd he had taken up braiding rugs because he had read such an activity was good for arthritis. He showed Todd several samples of his work, and Todd dutifully admired them. The boy had grown quite a bit, had he not? Well, 2 inches. Had Dusander given up smoking? No, but he had been forced to cut down. They made him cough too much now. How had his schoolwork been? Challenging, but exciting. He had made all A's and B's, had gone to the state finals with his science fair project on solar power, and was now thinking of majoring in anthropology instead of history when he got to college. Who was mowing Dusander's lawn this year? Randy Chambers, from just down the street. A good boy, but rather fat and slow. During that year, Dusander had put an end to 3 winos in his kitchen. He had been approached at the downtown bus stop some 20 times, had made the drink, dinner, bath, and bed offer 7 times. He had been turned down 2 times, and on 2 other occasions the winos had simply walked off with the quarters Dusander gave them for the fare box. After some thought, he had worked out a way around this. He simply bought a book of coupons. They were $2.50, good for 15 rides, and non-negotiable at the local liquor stores. On very warm days just lately, Dusander had noticed an unpleasant smell drifting up from his cellar. He kept his doors and windows firmly shut on these days. Todd Bowden had found a wino sleeping it off in an abandoned drainage culvert behind a vacant lot on Cienega Way. This had been in December, during the Christmas vacation. He had stood there for some time, hands stuffed into his pockets, looking at the wino and trembling. He had returned to the lot 6 times over a period of 5 weeks, always wearing his light jacket, zipped halfway up to conceal the craftsman hammer tucked into his belt. At last he had come upon the wino again, that one or some other, and who really gave a fuck, on the first day of March. He had begun with the hammer end of the tool, and then at some point, he didn't really remember when, everything had been swimming in a red haze, he had switched to the claw end, obliterating the wino's face. For Kurt Dusander, the winos were a half-cynical propitiation of gods he had finally recognized, or re-recognized. And the winos were fun. They made him feel alive. He was beginning to feel that the years he had spent in Santo Donato, the years before the boy had turned up on his doorstep with his big blue eyes and his wide American grin, had been years spent being old before his time. He had been just past his mid-60s when he came here, and he felt much younger than that now. The idea of propitiating gods would have startled Todd at first, but it might have gained eventual acceptance. After stabbing the wino under the train platform, he had expected his nightmares to intensify, to perhaps even drive him crazy. He had expected waves of paralyzing guilt that might well end with a blurted confession or the taking of his own life. Instead of any of those things, he had gone to Hawaii with his parents and enjoyed the best vacation of his life. He had begun high school last September, feeling oddly new and refreshed, as if a different person had jumped into his Todd Bowden skin. Things that had made no particular impression on him since earliest childhood, the sunlight just after dawn, the look of the ocean off the fish pier, the sight of people hurrying on a downtown street at just that moment of dusk when the streetlights come on, these things now imprinted themselves on his mind again, in a series of bright cameos, in images so clear they seemed electroplated. He tasted life on his tongue like a draught of wine straight from the bottle. After he had seen the stew bum in the culvert, but before he killed him, the nightmares had begun again. The most common one involved the wino he had stabbed to death in the abandoned train yard. Home from school, he burst into the house, a cheery, "Hi, Monica, baby," on his lips. It died there, as he saw the dead wino in the raised breakfast nook. He was sitting slumped over their butcher block table in his puke-smelling shirt and pants. Blood had streaked across the bright tiled floor. It was drying on the stainless steel counters. There were bloody handprints on the natural pine cupboards. Clipped to the noteboard by the fridge was a message from his mother. "Todd, gone to the store, back by 3:30. The hands of the stylish sunburst clock over the Gen Air range stood at 3:20. And the drunk was sprawled dead up there in the nook like some horrid oozing relic from the subcellar of a junk shop, and there was blood everywhere, and Todd began trying to clean it up, wiping every exposed surface, all the time screaming at the dead wino that he had to go, had to leave him alone, and the wino just lolled there and stayed dead, grinning up at the ceiling, and freshets of blood kept pouring from the stab wounds in his dirty skin. Todd grabbed the O-Cedar mop from the closet and began to slided madly back and forth across the floor, aware that he was not really getting the blood up, only diluting it, spreading it around, but unable to stop. And just as he heard his mother's town and country wagon turn into the driveway, he realized the wino was Dusander. He woke from these dreams, sweating and gasping, clutching double handfuls of the bedclothes. But after he finally found the wino in the culvert again, that wino or some other, and used the hammer on him, these dreams went away. He supposed he might have to kill again, and maybe more than once. It was too bad, but of course their time of usefulness as human creatures was over, except their usefulness to Todd, of course. And Todd, like everyone else he knew, was only tailoring his lifestyle to fit his own particular needs as he grew older. Really, he was no different than anybody. You had to make your own way in the world. If you were going to get along, you had to do it by yourself. 15. In the fall of his junior year, Todd played varsity tailback for the Santa Donato Cougars and was named All-Conference. And in the second quarter of that year, the quarter which ended in late January of 1977, he won the American Legion Patriotic Essay Contest. This contest was open to all city high school students who were taking American history courses. Todd's piece was called "An American's Responsibility." During the baseball season that year, he was the school's star pitcher, winning four and losing none. His batting average was .361. At the awards assembly in June, he was named Athlete of the Year and given a plaque by Coach Haynes. Coach Haynes, who had once taken him aside and told him to keep practicing his curve, because none of these niggers can hit a curveball, Bowden, not one of them. Monica Bowden burst into tears when Todd called her from school and told her he was going to get the award. Dick Bowden strutted around his office for 2 weeks following the ceremony, trying not to boast. That summer they rented a cabin in Big Sur and stayed there for 2 weeks, and Todd snorkeled his brains out. During that same year, Todd killed four derelicts. He stabbed two of them and bludgeoned two of them. He had taken to wearing two pairs of pants on what he now acknowledged to be hunting expeditions. Sometimes he rode the city buses looking for likely spots. The best two, he found, were the Santo Donato Mission for the Indigent on Douglas Street and around the corner from the Salvation Army on Euclid. He would walk slowly through both of these neighborhoods, waiting to be panhandled. When a wino approached him, Todd would tell him that he, Todd, wanted a bottle of whiskey, and if the wino would buy it, Todd would share the bottle. He knew a place, he said, where they could go. It was a different place every time, of course. He resisted a strong urge to go back either to the train yard or to the culvert behind the vacant lot on Cienega Way. Revisiting the scene of a previous crime would have been unwise. During the same year, Dusander smoked sparingly, drank ancient-age bourbon, and watched TV. Todd came by once in a while, but their conversations became increasingly arid. They were growing apart. Dusander celebrated his 79th birthday that year, which was also the year Todd turned 16. Dusander remarked that 16 was the best year of a young man's life, 41 the best year of a middle-aged man's, and 79 the best of an old man's. Todd nodded politely. Dusander had been quite drunk and cackled in a way that made Todd distinctly uneasy. Dusander had dispatched two winos during Todd's academic year of 1976 and 77. The second had been livelier than he looked. Even after Dusander had gotten the man suddenly drunk, he had tottered around the kitchen with the haft of a steak knife jutting from the base of his neck, gushing blood down the front of his shirt and onto the floor. The wino had rediscovered the front hall after two staggering circuits of the kitchen and had almost escaped the house. Dusander had stood in the kitchen, eyes wide with shocked unbelief, watching the wino grunt and puff his way toward the door, rebounding from one side of the hall to the other and knocking cheap Currier and Ives reproductions to the floor. His paralysis had not broken until the wino was actually groping for the doorknob. Then Dusander had bolted across the room, jerked open the utility drawer, and pulled out his meat fork. He ran down the hall with the meat fork held out in front of him and drove it into the wino's back. Dusander had stood over him, panting, his old heart racing in a frightening way, racing like that of a heart attack victim on that Saturday night TV program he enjoyed, Emergency. But at last it had slowed back into a normal rhythm, and he knew he was going to be all right. There had been a great deal of blood to clean up. That had been 4 months ago, and since then he had not made his offer at the downtown bus stop. He was frightened of the way he had almost bungled the last one, but when he remembered the way he had handled things at the last moment, pride rose in his heart. In the end, the wino had never made it out the door, and that was the important thing. 16. In the fall of 1977, during the first quarter of his senior year, Todd joined the Rifle Club. By June of 1978, he had qualified as a marksman. He made all-conference in football again, won 5 and lost 1 during the baseball season, the loss coming as the result of 2 errors and 1 unearned run, and made the 3rd highest merit scholarship score in the school's history. He applied to Berkeley and was promptly accepted. By April, he knew he would either be valedictorian or salutatorian on graduation night. He very badly wanted to be valedictorian.